Okay, so we are building our faith when we look at these things. And I want to show you something today, and I don't mean this in, it's hard to not say it, and not, it is hyperbole, it's a figure of speech. But what I'm going to show you today, I think it's going to blow your mind, okay? It blows my mind. I was going over this showing my wife some of my slides, and she said, I don't understand that. And I said, good, you're not supposed to understand it. I don't understand it either, because what we're going to talk about today is not understandable. We can barely conceive it. So I don't want to go into too much background, once again, because of time. Previous MDCs, I've given these points, and we've discussed them at length. But when we talk about God's workmanship, we understand that something does not come from nothing. Dink talked a little about this in his first lesson, the design argument, the teleological argument, the cosmological, all the different arguments. Empirical observation, that means things that we take in with our senses, can reveal that God exists. We know Paul says that in Romans chapter 1, and we'll look at that here in a little bit again. But it does not explain God, anything about God. He has to reveal to us in explanation himself. We can look at his creation as we can look at the pot that the potter makes, and we can understand that it was made, but it doesn't give us any information other than that about the potter. He has to reveal himself to us, which he has done. The Bible is not a science textbook, and so we should not go to it for the purpose of science. That doesn't mean there are not some scientific things in there. That doesn't mean application can't be made, but that means that it's not a, it's just like it's not a cookbook, it's not a math textbook, it's not a science book. And science is a category of men's wisdom. And so all this information we take in, the conclusions that we draw from the created world around us, the facts that we gather, it is still man's wisdom. This is something that is our wisdom, and we need to make sure that we keep it in perspective, that not only is science frequently wrong, but man's wisdom is nothing compared to God's. Science admits it's wrong. In fact, it's a scientific tenet that most of science is incorrect. It's a growing, it is not an absolute understanding. So keep those things in mind. We also covered a lot of these in the previous talks. I do want to go to Psalm chapter 8, though. I don't think we've quoted this one yet. If you turn to Psalm chapter 8, David says in verse 4, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visited him? And so he's looking up at the sky. We recently had a series of psalm lessons here at the BCS congregation. Brother Tom Moore is doing those, and he covered all of this in Psalm 8, and he contributed some of the ideas into this lesson today. But in Psalm 8, David is looking up at the sky, probably at night, because he references looking at the moon and the stars, seeing this marvelous creation that is painted on the dome of the sky, the heavenly canvas. What they understood about what they were looking at, I don't think they understood much about it, but when they're looking up at the night sky and he's seeing all of these marvelous things, he's considering what is the position of man. And so if we look at Genesis chapter 1, we know that God created everything in those 6 days, and he takes from the dust of the earth to make man, and he sets man at the pinnacle of this creation. Psalm 8 is reflective or parallel to those ideas. And so David is saying, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Basically, what God has done is he's created this entire marvelous universe, and he's taken this pile of dust and set it at the very top of things. That's us. We're that pile of dust that has been what in verse 5? Crowned with honor and glory and given dominion in verse 5 over all of these things of God's hand. And so we are the masters of the universe in which we live, and that is a God-given thing. We need to keep that in mind. And so in one aspect, you can look at creation and you can think of how small we are. And in another aspect of it, you can understand that that small thing God has put over everything in the physical universe. I'm talking here. That's what I'm limiting this to. So yes, we're small, but we're also mighty. We've been made only a little lower than the angels. John talked about in the Tower of Babel, God specifically says we need to confound their language because there's nothing that man imagines that he won't be able to do. I think that reveals the power that God has placed into man, especially in man's imagination, and the power that we have been granted. But we know, for example, in Job 38, God uses the creation to Job, to humble Job. Job is becoming prideful and making assumptions, and God has to use the creation as an example, saying, where were you when I did this? Where were you when I did this? Look at this. What do you see? And that humbles Job, and he arrives at a proper conclusion by the end of the chapter. In Romans chapter 1, verse 20, Paul explicitly says that the visible things of the creation reveal the invisible things, the divine, that they exist, so that man, looking at creation, is without excuse. Usually when we think of things, we think of just the sky and the heavenly objects, but I want to broaden that for us a little bit today. And we know that King Agur, possibly there, Solomon, at least Solomon is writing it down in Proverbs verse chapter 30, verse 18. He's looking at creation here, not the things of the sky, but he still sees amazement. He says, four wonderful things do I see. And he references the ship on the sea, the bird that's flying. Like, how does a bird fly? That was something that was beyond their understanding from a scientific perspective, but beyond our understanding at one time. And it was absolutely amazing. So men were able to look at creation around them, not just the sky, and see the amazing things that God has put there. So Dink liked pretty pictures, and he's not here. There he is. He's in the back. What is this a picture of? Who knows? Anybody? No, this is in the Milky Way. These are the Pleiades. So if you look in Job chapter 38, this is referenced. Job 38, verse 31, several things in the sky are referenced. One of them is the Pleiades. This is called the Seven Sisters. There are six or seven bright stars that you can see. Usually in the winter is the best. At night with the naked eye, there's actually about 1,000 of them. This is an open star cluster. These are stars that are moving in the Milky Way, and they're kind of moving in the same direction at the same speed, and so they're related to each other gravitationally. This is just outside of or near the constellation of Orion. Let's see, that's going to do the wrong thing. I don't. So this is the constellation of Orion with the dots connected. Once again, this is a winter constellation, also referenced in Job 38. And so why do I bring this up here? Because this is going to come up here in a second. The point is that this is a thing that God showed Job, that Job already knew what it was. Job already knew what this thing was in the sky. And God said, what is that thing? Who are you? Did you make this? Where were you when I did this? He points to that thing, and Job knows what it is. But does Job know what it is? To Job, it's just something that's painted on the heavenly dome, what I'm calling it this morning. It's like living inside a planetarium. He sees it. It's a pretty picture. It's amazing. But what is it? Did Job understand what it is? And I don't think so. And so the question is when we find out what it is, does that make it less amazing? Does that take away from the argument that God has made? Well, once we figure out what it is, we're no longer amazed by it. Well, let's think about that as we move forward. So when we're talking about what the ancients, and I'm grouping everybody here together, Job, David, Solomon, Paul in Romans chapter 1, I'm grouping them all together here, just calling them the ancients. When the ancients looked at the world around them, okay, when they looked at the tiniest seed, when they looked at the birds flying, when they looked at that dome of heaven, they were amazed. But even the pagans understood there was divine. And so they create gods, false gods, to explain all these things. The God of the sun, the God of the moon, the God of the rivers, the God of the ocean. So they understand, they have that understanding that is exactly the point of creation, was to reveal the existence of the divine. And we have records of scientists in ancient civilizations. We know that the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Chinese, they all had naturalists, they all had scientists, they all had astronomers. And so up until even like the 18th century, the Greek physician Galen's work was being used. We know that Aristotle and then his work through Copernicus was used up until the Renaissance. We know that the Chinese for 1,000 years wrote down every single comet, every single eclipse, every single thing. And you can go back to Chinese records and you can find where they wrote all of these things down. And so people have been recording this information for a very, very long time. So they saw something and they knew that the divine existed. So in the book of Romans, when Paul says, you Romans, and then by extension everybody, you're without excuse, what exactly were they seeing? And I'm going to give away the punchline just in case I run out of time, because I think I'm going to. The point is if they were able to look at the world that they saw, the scope of the world that they saw, and be convinced that God existed, that the divine existed, what happens to us when we now have an even broader perspective? How much less excuse do we have today? And so there are people who think that with scientific discovery, you need less God. You can explain away God. And I see it in exactly the opposite perspective. The more we understand, the more amazing that God is. And so I want to show us the perspective comparing what Paul was talking about, what they could see in Romans 1 that should have been convincing, with what we can see today to show us a little bit of perspective. So how vast is the creation? All of creation, every single thing in creation, I'm going to talk about here in the next 30 minutes. So when we're talking about empirical, and then we're talking about the concept of vastness, we're talking about measurement. So you can measure things in a lot of ways. You can just count them. So for example, in David's day and Paul's day, when they looked up at the night sky, depending on what they were, the mountain they were standing on, and if it was cloudy and how good their vision was, they could see between 3,000 and 4,000 stars at night in the northern hemisphere. So you could count. You can count them. And there are philosophers and scientists who counted, and there's books that are ancient that record like 1,000 named stars, because there were so many to them, they didn't even name them all. They named the prominent ones. So that's about how many stars there were in that day from that could be seen. Our question is, what's behind what can be seen? You can also measure length. So length, width, depth. And then you have also the concept of distance. Those aren't exactly the same, but you have units. So there's cubits in the Bible. There are also, we use inches and feet. Inches and feet and yards are not metric. They're not decimal systems. So in science, there's meters, millimeters, centimeters, kilometers. That's a metric system, and so it's easier to convert units because it's a decimal system. Everything is divisible by 10. We do that with our money. You have, 10 pennies make a dime, 10 dimes make a dollar. We understand it, even if we don't use the metric system. And then you have a light year. You have weight, mass. So you have talents in the Bible, grams and pounds, and you can go on with volume, with time. You can combine these, and so density is a measurement you can make, how dense something is. That's weight over volume. Speed, electricity has units. Joules or watts or BTUs in energy. Pressure has millibars, PSI. And so we measure the world around us constantly. Even if you don't think of yourself as a scientist, you're going to check your tire gauge, and it's the digital one today, and you're going to push it. It's going to be a number you don't recognize because there's three different units. You have to push it three times to get to PSI, right? And we understand what that means. We can count with our money. And so we understand units and we understand measuring. And so like I said, the metric system, in this case, we're going to talk about length. So that's the one I've chosen for the vastness lesson today. So meters specifically, and then light years a little bit. But it's a decimal system. So a millimeter is a tenth of a centimeter. A centimeter is a tenth of a decimeter. We don't use that one too much. Deci means tenth. A meter is the unit. 10 times that, the decameter, 10, and you go up to kilometer, which is a kilo, is 1,000. So I think we understand the prefixes there. The problem is, they're easy to convert. The problem is that you have a lot of zeros. Okay, you have to write 0000000. So how can we make that easier for the discussion that we're having today? And that in science is called the scientific notation. So you take a number like a million, and you turn it into a decimal point, 1 point something times 10 to the sixth. So 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10, that's 6 zeros, and you tack them on to whatever your coefficient is. So 1.0 here is the coefficient. It is in red, and then times 10 to the sixth, that's all the zeros. That's the way to abbreviate it. So a light year is 9,460,000,000,000 7,730,472,580,800 meters. That's how far light goes in a year. Well, it's a whole lot easier to say 9.46 times 10 to the 15. You just, all those other digits, yeah, they matter, but we're talking about such big numbers that you just round it off and you don't worry about it. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about the number in blue, or yeah, it's in blue, 6 or 15 is the exponent here, because we're talking about factors. We're talking about orders of magnitude. So if I say something is two orders of magnitude larger than something else or smaller than something else in length, I'm talking about a factor of 10 or 100 or 1,000. So a millimeter is three factors lower than a meter. A kilometer is three orders of magnitude larger than a meter, because a meter is one, a kilometer is 1,000, right? Well, what happens when we talk about millions and billions and trillions? Those are factors, orders of magnitude that go up and up and up. 6 is a million. 9 would be a billion. And another thing that we can do then is I can take those exponents and I can put them on a line. This is just for illustrative purposes, okay? This is just to help us understand. Brother Carey put me in a tough spot. I have to do an apologetics lesson that can be understood by 99-year-old women and 3-year-old children. And all of y'all in here are somewhere in between that. So if y'all don't understand this, it's not my fault, okay? Quite the task. So we can take it and put it on a line just so we can understand it. So the meter is in the middle, and a little bit lower is on one side, and a little bit higher is on the other side. And you go up. Every line here, though, is an order of magnitude. We're going up by a factor of 10. So that's, for example, the Richter scale. When you hear that you have an earthquake that's a 4.0 versus a 5.0, you go, oh, that's just one point. But that's a magnitude higher. Okay? That's a huge difference. When you go from 4 to 6, that's a huge difference. It's only 2, but you're talking in orders of magnitude there, not just, you know, in multiples. It's not the difference between being 6'2" and 6'4". That's not an order of magnitude. That's in the same, those two men would be the same order of magnitude as far as size. So once again, when we're talking about the Bible and what men would have known in the first century and further back, we can use some discrete objective, some discrete objects that we read of in Scripture. So in Luke chapter 13, Jesus uses the parable of the mustard seed. Now exactly which plant is under consideration is up for debate. The Scripture clearly says that it's big enough for birds to lodge in, so I picked the one that's an actual tree. There is one that's smaller than that that we're probably more familiar with here, but you can see the tree, and in the person's palm of their hand, this is the fruit. This is going to take... Okay, I don't know where the thing is. Okay, y'all just have to follow verbal cues. So in the palm of their hand, there's a bunch of the little red fruits. That's actually the fruit, and the seed is still inside that yet. So this is one of the plants that's in contention for being the mustard seed that Jesus uses in that parable. Well, that seed is about 3 millimeters long. Okay, so we're talking about things that would, Paul says, you can look at creation, understand God exists. We're giving ourselves some points on that line. So 3 millimeters. Jonah was swallowed by a great fish, the Scripture says. We don't know what that fish was. The largest sea-dwelling animal, in fact, it's the largest creature that we know of in all of history, even dinosaurs, is the blue whale. A large one that can be larger than this would be about 30 meters, so about 100 feet long, but 30 meters. And a fish can be a whale. Once again, in taxonomy, that's a different apologetics class as to how we categorize things. But so what we have here is something that's 3 millimeters in length versus something that's 30 meters in length. Keep in mind that a human man, 2 meters would be about 6'5". 2 meters. So this fish, this whale, is 30 meters. So if we put this on our line, these two objects on our line, we see that we cover 1, 2, 3, 4 orders of magnitude. The mustard seed is 4 orders of magnitude smaller than the blue whale. The blue whale is 4 orders of magnitude larger than the mustard seed. The blue whale is an order of magnitude, approximately, bigger than an adult man. The mustard seed would be 3 orders of magnitude smaller than a man. So these are just relatives. It depends what you're talking about is the comparison you're making. So that's on our line. So let's pull out a little bit. Once again, some things that they might understand. The width of a single human hair is 0.1 millimeter. That would be 1 times 10 to the minus 4 in orders of magnitude. So an order of magnitude smaller than the mustard seed. The Sea of Galilee at its widest point north to south is about 21 kilometers wide. So the north-south dimension, east and west, it's shorter. But up and down, it's 21 kilometers. That's about 2.1 times 10 to the 4. And now an order of magnitude larger than the blue whale. So once again, we're thinking about men in the first century when they look at creation, thinking of length. What do they understand creation to be? What do they see as big? What do they see as small? And so what we've just done now, from a human hair to the Sea of Galilee, we've got 8 orders of magnitude in size. Yes, there's things like mountains, okay, but how, like, where does this mountain begin and that mountain ends? I'm trying to talk about, as an example, discrete objects that you could go, oh, the Sea of Galilee, I know exactly what you mean. If you're standing on either Mount Zion or the Mount of Olives, and you look out the horizon, once again, depending on how tall you are, how good you can see, what the weather is like, the atmosphere that day, you can see about 100 kilometers. Okay, that's another order of magnitude. We're now at 100. Here we're at 20. Now we're at 100. So you've gone up by a zero is the point. So standing on the Mount of Olives, you can see 100 kilometers away. Now that's distance. That's not the same thing as length exactly, because we're not talking about an object. But that gives us an idea of the bigness that they would have understood the universe to be. So when Jonah is looking at the Pleiades, Job, how big is that? Well, it's on the dome of the sky. So once again, we see the sky as a two-dimensional screen, but it's not. There's depth. It's three dimensions. We just don't have a point of reference. So did Job understand that that thing was much bigger than the Sea of Galilee? I don't think so, because he's just seeing it as a painting. When we watch a car commercial today and you see the car on your TV screen go by, we understand that that's a real full-size car. It's not a little miniature going by on our TV screen. It represents something. But I don't think they understood that that represented something. So the scale of creation that Paul says men without excuse are, and let's be generous and let's add one on either side, is about 10 orders of magnitude, from a minus 5 to a plus 5 in size. Once again, if you don't understand it specifically, that's okay. I think generally we're talking about comparisons. We're talking about how big the world is and everything in it. So this size range explains just about everything that a man, a woman, anybody in the first century would have understood as existing in the world. Once again, we're not talking about counting or any of the other ways to measure. We're just talking about, length. So that leaves men without excuse, those 10 orders of magnitude. Okay, we're not including the heavens yet, because I don't think they understood what those were. So let's skip forward quite a bit in time. Approximately in 1609, Galileo invented the telescope. Now, he didn't invent it. He took somebody else's idea. That's what a good scientist does anyway, and he rejiggered it and called it his. He wasn't the first one to do it, and he's certainly not the last one to do it. He took an invention and improved on it. The same thing happens with the microscope a little later on. But what Galileo does here at the height of the Renaissance, and so we have men who are, they are not atheists, but they believe in reason, they believe in the use of empirical knowledge, they are anti-superstitious, they are taking the things that Aristotle said, all those ancient philosophers, and they're kind of going, you know, this doesn't really make sense with what we're seeing. And so they're reevaluating all of that. Galileo takes this thing called the telescope that he invents or that he improves upon, and he looks up into the sky. Specifically, he looks at the planet Jupiter, and what does he see? He discovers the 4 largest moons of Jupiter. Once again, this is groundbreaking. Why? Because for the first time, objects were observed that clearly did not orbit the Earth. They orbited something else. First, they orbited Jupiter. That throws the world into chaos. It turns the Catholic Church upside down. The model of the universe at the time was that the Earth was at the center of everything, and everything went around the Earth. And so with this telescope making this observation of observable fact, He takes these superstitions of men and turns them upside down, causes quite a bit of trouble for himself, okay? He didn't lose his life because of it. Earlier men did. The Catholic Church was very powerful at this time. But the point is that that object now that he makes, the telescope, was able to reveal something in the sky that men had never seen before. Paul did not know that Jupiter had moons, even if he understood what Jupiter was. And so we have an example of something now. When Paul says, this should convince you, now we've got something that we can add to that. If this was convincing, is the new thing still convincing? Absolutely. So we're going to skip a lot of stuff. Our sun, these are modern measurements. Galileo wouldn't have known this specifically. Our sun is approximately 1.3 times 10 to the ninth meters, so about a billion meters wide. 10 to the 9. And so what I've just done on the screen is I've moved down that line to the 10 to the 9 spot with the little blue box, because what we're doing is we're adding on to what the observable universe would have been in Romans chapter 1. So now the sun alone, and there's lots of other things, the sun bumps you up 4 orders of magnitude from where you were, if you understand it. And I'm combining times and dates, and we're thinking of now with all of this knowledge. Telescopes didn't stay little bitty. They became enormous. Now you have huge buildings you can go to. We have them in outer space. Telescopes not only look at visible light, they can look at other electromagnetic radiation. They can look at X-rays. They can look at radio waves. They can look at heat. So we can see the universe in ways that our eyes don't reveal to us with these machines. The Pleiades, remember I said there were six or seven, depending on how many you could see. So this is a schematic of the relative sizes of those stars that we now today know those are giant balls of fusion plasma out in the universe somewhere doing kind of the same thing that our sun is doing for us. That little orange dot at the end is our sun. The largest one of these, Alcyone, is the one on my right, your left, I don't know whichever direction it is a order of magnitude larger than our sun. So now 10 to the 10th. So 10 billion, right? Yeah. 10 billion meters wide. And you can just keep doing this. So this orange star here that the arrow is pointing to, I think it comes from an Arab word that was Germanicized. Anyway, you would say, if you were pronouncing it in German, it would be something like Betelgeuse, but in English we call it, this star is Betelgeuse. That's what this star is called. You can go out and see it. It's in the winter specifically. Right now it's outside up right now in the sky, but we can't see it because the sun is also up, you know, as the orbits and everything moves around us. This is a nighttime constellation. This is the constellation Orion, also mentioned in Job chapter 38 and other places in scripture. If you connect the dots, it looks like a hunter with a bow and arrow, with the bow shooting. And the thing that he's shooting at in the sky, because men are imaginative, the stars line up and look like a bull. That's Taurus the bull. Taurus is in the zodiac. The zodiac probably is also mentioned in Job chapter 38 as Maseroth. That would be the orbit, all of the constellations that the sun goes through in a year. Because when you have no television or no internet, you sit around at night and you watch the sky. So they were very, very good at it. They knew where everything was. Betelgeuse is the big orange circle here. Another, in fact, I think this one's two orders of magnitude larger than the last one we talked about. So you very quickly lose track. These numbers are unfathomable, okay? We cannot understand numbers at this scale. They do not make any sense at all, and yet it's there. So this constellation is up. It's very easy to see. And that star in the sky, you can look at it with your naked eye. Once again, depending on how your vision is, and you can see that it's red. Okay. This is about 500 light years away. So the Pleiades cluster. So we take the entire cluster of stars. Once again, that's a little more distance, but we're still kind of talking about a grouping of objects. Now we're at the size of that is 1.42 times 10 to the 17 meters. So if you remember a few slides ago, a light year was 16 Now we're at 17. So now we're an order of magnitude larger than light years. So this is about 14 or so light years wide is this object of stars. We can call it that because they all kind of move in the same direction. They're like moving as a group. So like a dozen eggs are all in the same carton. Well, these are all kind of, they all seem like astronomically they're in the same carton for some reason. We can keep going. The Andromeda Galaxy. So this galaxy, you can see this at night. This is one of the few objects in the northern sky that is not in the Milky Way galaxy. We did not know that until 1924. Once again, think about what Paul said men were left without excuse on. Okay? 2,000 years ago. The Andromeda Galaxy was not discovered until, I'll do a Jason quote, discovered until 1924. Up until then, it was thought that it was just a dust cloud in our own galaxy. The entire universe in 1924 was only the Milky Way galaxy. The entire universe was one galaxy. That's what they thought. Well, Hubble, Irwin Hubble, Hubble Space Telescope is named after him. He did a lot of very important things in astronomy. He was able to calculate, and I can kind of explain to you if you want to know later how they measure these distances. You know, they're close enough for the purposes of this talk today. That object is 2 billion light years away from the Milky Way galaxy. But here I'm not talking about distance, I'm talking about size in and of it itself. The width of the Andromeda galaxy is 10 to the 21 meters. So we just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, the scale of things. And this is one galaxy that's the nearest to us. We now know that the universe, okay, I don't have a picture of this, is full of trillions of galaxies. Not just one, like in 1924. And this is only within the last 100 years. Okay? Paul and Jonah and Job and David had no idea, and yet they still understood that God created everything. So the width of the observable universe, so I don't want to talk about distance, but the universe, we can think of it as the thing. And observable here in science doesn't mean what in English you kind of think it means, but it's good enough, is 10 to the 26 meters wide. Or long, okay? What's on the other side of that has been undiscovered, because this is all we can observe. In fact, it means all that is observable under any condition ever. So from a scientific perspective, there is nothing bigger than this. This is the biggest thing possible, once again, with our understanding. No telling what we find in another 100 years. So when we talk about vast, we usually think of the sky, right? So look at how the line has increased. The yellow is what Paul knew and what men were responsible for in the first century. And now look how much we've added to it in the blue and in the purple on that orders of magnitude line. Right? We can go the other way. The width of an E. coli bacteria, 10 to the minus 6. The width of the COVID-19 virus particle, 10 to the 7th, so an order of magnitude smaller than an E. coli. The width of a strontium atom, so this is one of the biggest atoms, is that little dot in the middle of those two electrodes. Okay, they were able to trap it, shine a laser beam at it, and it emitted a light back that was catchable by a camera. So this is visible light. For all intents and purposes, this is a naked eye image. Okay, but that strontium atom is 10 to the minus 10 meters. So less than a millimeter, less than a millionth of a meter, less than a billionth of a meter. That's how tiny it is, and it's one of the largest. Okay, this picture was taken in 2018. So we keep pushing the edge of what we can know and what we can understand. So if you keep going smaller, now we're to the red. Okay, the width of a proton. Atoms are made up of protons and neutrons and electrons. The width of the proton, so now we're into subatomic particles, is 10 to the minus 15. And now is when all things kind of get all wacky. Okay, if you've heard of quantum computers, that's all in the news lately. We're into the quantum realm of things. The width, another quote, Jason quote, the width of an electron is probably 10 to the minus 18. But you know what? We're starting to get to the point where electrons might not exist. You know, nothing really exists at this scale. Nothing that's fathomable. We can't understand it. All you have at this scale is probable, okay? Probabilities are what's existing. Now, we know the universe works, okay? you can take it and you can plug your electricity in, your cord in, and the electric comes on, right? Not exactly electron, but it works. So things work around us, but the more we understand, the less we seem to understand. So that strontium atom was just cut and pasted from last time. So the width of an electron, three orders of magnitude smaller. So here is, this is theoretical, so this is not observable in any way, shape, or form. But based on our current theories in science, and take that for what it's worth, there's a limit to how small things can be, and that's the Planck limit. And it's 1.65 times 10 to the minus 35. That is the smallest possible length at which our theories of gravity still make sense. Once again, you have to understand it. The point is that everything, you can keep cutting things so small till it no longer makes any sense whatsoever. And so look at what we've done now. And some of that's, once again, just within the last few decades of all of this research. The yellow is what Paul says, you're responsible for this. You can look into creation and you can see that God exists. You can see the visible things. That points to the divine. That should convince you then to search out God. Well, look at how broad we are now. It also means, look at the lines. The things that are smaller than we can see are more vast than the entire observable universe. So when we look into the night sky and every telescope we have and every galaxy and everything all the way to the edge of the universe, that range of sizes is smaller than everything that's smaller than what we can see. The tiny things, the invisible things, are more numerous and more vast than the things that we can see. So, if Paul to the Romans, I have no idea where I am on time. Jason hadn't been looking. Okay, we're going to have some questions then. I was worried, so I spoke fast. And say I should have told a joke. I'd have had time. If they were without excuse, how many excuses do we have? We have none. There are no excuses today whatsoever. The more that we discover in science should convince men more and more and more to seek out God, not to do the opposite. You know, people will tell me, so this is an argument that I would get from science, scientists. Like, you study the DNA code and you understand how things work, and then you take men's theories, men's explanations for those things, and they drift from God. You know, students go to college and they take science classes and they lose their faith. Okay, I don't understand that. It's the way that it's being taught. It's the perspective that they have. Everything I have ever learned, more that God exists. And the thing that I'm able to do, once again, my friends can all tell you how humble I am, is that scientists are very prideful people. They have the keys to the ivory tower. They think they know it all. They make decisions and they, you know, Peyton talked about some of this. You have all these models that predict all this and they were wrong and oops. You know, all kinds of people's lives are ruined, by government policy of these things, and they just move on with their arrogance. I have no idea. So people will say, well, how do you explain this? How do you explain this? How do you explain this? I don't know. But that doesn't shake my faith just because I can't explain something. I'm not omniscient. I make no claim to be. But science does. Science thinks it can understand everything. There are people today looking for a theory of everything. You'll occasionally hear that too, especially that brings in the quantum mechanics and all the stuff that we've kind of done since Einstein. They're looking for a theory that explains everything, okay? I don't know that they're going to find it. And even if they do find it, it's probably wrong, okay? Right now they're fighting over all the different possibilities and choices. And even if they do find it, God is still on the other side of it. Because what you have here, when you go back to this line and think about this, you have right here in this, we are looking into the mind of God. Because that's the only way that the Planck limit can exist. That's the only way that electrons can exist. That is the mind of God. And so when we read in Genesis, God created light, let light come into existence, and it did. Okay, it came in fully functional. It came in mature. I believe it came into existence in transit. It came in functional. So when the scripture tells us that God created the fowls of the air, I think that means that there were birds, that there were nests in the trees, that there were already eggs in the nests, that there were already birds flying in the air. I believe the entire ecosystem, everything needed to support it, also was brought into existence at the same time. And so when you think, oh yeah, God created birds, God created stars, it sounds like it's, he created only like six or seven things that first day. No, brethren, he created everything. The way, not only the way it's maintained, but the things not only that don't exist, but that make the world work that are completely unexplainable. Okay? So in Proverbs, it says, you know, a bird in the air is amazing. Okay, and I agree. And I can explain to you a little bit about thrust and lift and aerodynamics and all of that. I still don't understand how a bird flies. Doesn't make sense. Now, that doesn't mean I can explain it scientifically, but with my emotional being, and I do have a few occasionally, I can't, it's amazing. Because why does that work? All of that came out of God's mind. Anyway, we're without excuse. The world without around us today is without excuse, just as much as they were in Paul's day or more. Most people aren't going to study this and understand it. So what is ironic is God has put in the world things that even when a discovery is made, they're still, it just pushes the boundary. They're still an edge. We're never going to figure it all out. God designed a system that we're in charge of that we're never going to understand. And I think it's to keep us humble. So Daniel asked, like, why do we have all these planets if we've been given dominion just to look at? Well, I think just to look at in a sense, because when we look at things, when you think the sky only has 4,000 stars in it, oh, that God exists. Well, I found a star we didn't know about. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that there's more. So now I'm even more convinced that God exists by looking at creation. So maybe the universe does just exist so that when we keep going and going and going, we are always without excuse. Maybe that means we're all going to live on Mars one day. I mean, maybe not me. Somebody will, you know. Why? Because the power is within man to do whatever is within his imagination from a physical, in a temporal standpoint. Anyway, and with AI and with all the languages kind of coming back together, you can go on Google right now and type a Spanish word, a Spanish thing in. You can even speak it. Boom, it tells you what it is in English. That's great. It's also kind of scary because what did God do the last time that happened? You know? Anyway, thank you very much.